The Israel Report for the latest news and insights with Anthony Reich.
Anthony Reich, a very, very good morning. How are you?
Tov Howard. We did have that little teaser yesterday about why Israel celebrates 2 days of Rosh Hashanah. I'm not quite sure if you actually discussed this. I heard that you might have discussed this already with Rolene, so I don't want to go over this.
No, so in fact, Rolene asked the question, and I asked the chief rabbi the question, but we were talking about so many other things that we actually didn't come back to it and get the answer, so I'd love to hear it from you.
Well, it's not linked to the fact that 2 days of Chag are celebrated, like for Pesach and for Shavuot and for Sukkot. There's no link between that fact and the fact that Israel celebrates 2 days of Rosh Hashanah. But the whole answer revolves around the fact that Rosh Hashanah is the only Chag in the Hebrew calendar that falls on Rosh Chodesh. That's the critical issue. And so in the old days when people didn't have Google Calendar and the Luach from the Rabbanut and all that kind of stuff, and we didn't know exactly what day the Chag was going to fall out on, it all revolved around the sighting of the new moon. And in the case of, for example, Pesach or Sukkot or whatever, the new moon sighting was a number of days before the Chag. So as soon as the new moon had been sighted and Rosh Chodesh was declared, they could then count 50 days in the case of Nisan until Pesach, and then celebrate Pesach on days which were already predetermined, at least for 15 days. But in the case of Rosh Hashanah, which falls on the first day on Rosh Chodesh, as soon as the new moon was sighted, you could already be in the middle of the day. It could already be kind of in the midst of what should really be a Chag day. And so for that reason, it was determined, instead of waiting to have the witnesses sight the new moon, that the Chag would already be perhaps even the day before the new moon is sighted, but perhaps not. And so 2 days were declared in order to avoid the possibility that the new moon was sighted in the middle of the day of Chag. Of course, the rabbis have since declared that the 2 days should really be regarded as one long day, although I get a little confused as to why you have to then have two morning services, two afternoon services, and two evening services in one very long day. But at least that's the reason that we're given as to why Rosh Hashanah is 2 days. Of course, it's strange because it's the only religion I know that has the new year falling on the first day of the seventh month of the year. But, you know, those are things that we can discuss in other shiurim. I'm sure the chief rabbi has answers for all of those things too.
Amazing. Really, really interesting. I actually want to start with the third thing that we were going to talk about today, because I want to make sure we have the time. I find when we start talking politics, we just always run out of time. But Israeli scientists claim that they may have found a cure for diabetes. I mean, this is massive. Absolutely massive.
This is massive. This is massive, and I have a strong personal interest in it as well. But this country, Betalene Therapeutics, has touted what they're calling the engineered micropancreas, which they claim could be a replacement for insulin injections for diabetes patients. And the way that kind of diabetes is managed at the moment, or the most sophisticated way that diabetes is managed at the moment, is with a combination of a continuous glucose monitor, which is sometimes hacked in order to be interfaced with an insulin pump. So in theory, your insulin pump could be pumping insulin on the basis of information which is gleaned from the glucose monitor, and human intervention is not required in that particular situation, because you've got the continuous glucose monitoring on the one side and the insulin being pumped on the other side. And so people have called this something of a pancreas, an engineered pancreas. But Betalene have gone one better, and they're using pig lung tissue and insulin secreting cells, which they aim to actually transplant into the body. And the interesting thing about the two interesting things about the issue of the pancreas is that the body doesn't really care where the pancreas physically is located. You could put a pancreas anywhere. As long as it secretes that insulin and does its job, it doesn't really matter where in the body it actually is located. But the other point is that they've actually, this crowd of scientists have actually been also using technology that will prevent the body from rejecting this this pancreas, this engineered pancreas, when it's eventually transplanted into the body. And we're told that this particular solution has been undergoing animal trials, those trials have already been completed. Human trials are expected as soon as next year. And this is going to be massively interesting for type 1 diabetics, for those who are insulin dependent. It doesn't cover the issue of type 2 diabetics, and often the two are very confused. Those diabetics whose bodies are producing insulin, but potentially their body is actually not absorbing the insulin. So this is really all about type 1, sometimes called child onset diabetes. And this could be a huge, huge breakthrough for those people suffering with type 1 diabetes.
Incredible, incredible. I'm just hoping that it was a statement responsibly made. You know, we have seen, unfortunately, some statements coming out of certain private companies that where, in fact, the results didn't lead to
weren't borne out in the end by something that was practical that could be used.
Yeah.
I mean, in the case of diabetes, there's a huge amount of effort, research going into diabetes at the moment, and the way that diabetes has been managed in the last few years has really come a long way. But this is something which is completely different. This is something which has not really been on the cards up until now, at least until I've read this very recently. And they're talking about a cure for diabetes. This is the term that's used, is this is a cure for diabetes. And that would be something massive if you could transplant this into the body and prevent the body from rejecting it, from having any rejection issues, because, you know, some diabetics say, why would I replace taking insulin drugs when I would just replace it with taking drugs to prevent the body from rejecting the transplanted organ? But if the body doesn't actually reject this, and if it produces the insulin in response to the body's blood glucose levels, this would be an amazing, amazing, amazing breakthrough.
Indeed. Please tell Anthony, well done for the two-day Rosh Hashanah explanation. The first time I've had a clear answer that I've heard, Shana Tova. That's from Steve Meltzer. And I have to tell you, Anthony, it's also always confused me. So thank you for that. All right. Let's talk a little bit about Prime Minister Netanyahu. The first day of the pre-indictment hearing against him ended yesterday after 10 hours of deliberation. Have any details been made public?
Well, there were some kind of announcements, some releases that were made during the day by the Netanyahu legal team. The legal team of the Attorney General didn't make any comment at all, and their idea was always going to be that this is a privately held thing, which is not going to be held in the public eye, which is not going to be publicized. And yet the Netanyahu legal team, led by Ram Kaspi, who is a very, very well-known legal personality in Israel, did make a certain statements during the course of the day, but nothing really dramatic, other than to say that they feel that they're going to be able to convince the Attorney General, because they are presenting information which he hasn't heard before, which is not familiar with, which is not aware of. And if that is the case, then obviously they would have some chance, I suspect, of being able to convince him, because up until now, at least, the Attorney General felt that he'd got access to all the information that he needed. And on that basis, it seems as if though he was quite strongly minded to, in fact, indict Prime Minister Netanyahu, particularly on that Bezeq case, which is called Case 4000. But anyway, we don't really know how well or badly the deliberations went yesterday. The Netanyahu legal team seemed to be quite upbeat about their chances of at least reducing the charges, if not making them go away completely. But we have no real idea of how that all went. Of course, the Prime Minister himself was not present at the hearing. This was being done just by his legal team and by the legal team of the Attorney General. Those deliberations will continue today, also on Sunday and Monday. I'm not sure that we're really going to hear any formal positions, announcements, press conferences, whatever, being made by the Attorney General until the moment comes when he says, look, I've heard what I need to hear, and I'm either proceeding to indict the Prime Minister or I'm not. And I think he needs to make his position clear one way or the other, but that's unlikely to be any time soon. I think they will take this information that they gather over the next few days and they will take their time to make a decision about it. Some people have speculated that we will not hear an answer until probably December. Wow. As to whether the Attorney General wishes to proceed with an indictment or not. But at least anyway, on the one side of Jerusalem, these discussions are going around, going on around Netanyahu's future as Prime Minister, and future, you know, whether he will be indicted or not. And on the other side of town, he continues his work to try and build a coalition, which has also had some interesting developments.
You know, as you were talking about that, I was thinking the stress that this guy must be under is actually unimaginable.
He must be under massive, massive stress. And I think that this just reinforces the point as to whether a sitting prime minister can logically be also in parallel undergoing this whole legal proceedings and legal investigation, and whether he can honestly devote his time, energy, effort, concentration to running the country in the way that the country really requires him to do.
You know, it's incredible because, if you think about Boris Johnson, you think about Donald Trump, you think about Netanyahu, the opposition and people that, that really, they're people that absolutely detest them, and they really will stop at nothing. You just wonder why at the end of the day anybody would put their hand up for this position.
I have wondered to myself who would want to be Prime Minister of Israel and who would actually even want to be a politician here, because the stresses are massive. And, you know, unfortunately, there are so many haters. There are so many people who come out hating that it just makes you wonder why people would wish to do it. And yet there are people who wish to subject themselves to this. You would like to think that it's all out of ulterior love for the country, and that they, you know, really have good things in their hearts that they wish to do rather than ulterior motives of trying to promote themselves and their personal positions. But unfortunately, the days of these kind of politicians that we remember, whose objective was simply just to represent the country the best way possible, we don't really see those old-fashioned sort of politicians around much more. And these days, unfortunately, people are constantly trying to do self-promotion rather than represent the country. But certainly, you know, it would be fair to say Prime Minister Netanyahu has done a great deal for the security and for the well-being of the state of Israel. He's really devoted a lot of his life to, you know, making sure that Israel is in a safe and a good place. And Israel has certainly prospered under his leadership. And there are people who think that he's done his job. And it's time now for him to say, you know, I've achieved many good things in my time, and it's time to go now. But he doesn't seem to agree with that right now.
Yeah, we've only got a few seconds left, but just tell us very quickly, a meeting has been set up between Prime Minister Netanyahu and Avigdor Lieberman to discuss the possibility of Lieberman joining the Likud-led coalition. How likely is this to succeed?
Well, I think it's pretty unlikely, because Lieberman has made his position very, very clear indeed. He will not sit in a government which includes ultra-Orthodox parties. He's made that clear. He's also made clear that he will not sit in a government that does not involve a national unity government, including both Kahol Lavan and Likud. And he's also been very anti the idea of Netanyahu continuing as prime minister. And that point, the third point, is not quite as strongly made as the first two. And so it would surprise me a lot if at this stage of the game, Lieberman gave in to what will be a very, very strong attempt, I imagine, by Prime Minister Netanyahu to convince him to sit in a Likud-led coalition. Let's not forget that Lieberman is the difference between a government or no government. And he was blamed by many for the fact that Israel had to go to a second round of elections. But on the other hand, I think a lot of the general public respect him for sticking by his guns and making a statement and being willing to stand by his position rather than to buckle when things were offered. So I don't think that this is going to be successful, but Netanyahu sees this as his only alternative right now, and I have no doubt that he's going to have a very, very good effort at trying to convince Lieberman to join him.
Time is 8:01. Anthony Reich, thank you as always. Hope you have a fantastic weekend. Shabbat Shalom, and we will catch you on Monday morning. Here's your news with Zanati.